And to present Odom, he's a senior fishery industry officer in charge of marketing issues with FAO since 1986. He has a Master Bachelor of Arts in Harvard and a PhD from Sea Fisheries Institute in Poland. So having said this, Odom, the floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Jonathan and I have decided to split this first presentation into two parts. I will talk about the more fishery-specific parts, trade and marketing issues, and then Jonathan will talk more about consumer issues, needs, trends, values, etc. Facilitating market access for producers. We will try very briefly to address some of the market access requirements, whether they are regulatory, mandatory, or non-regulatory or voluntary. I'll talk a little bit about trends in product development and distribution, and then Jonathan will talk about evolving consumer needs. And I'd also like to mention that, of course, this presentation or these two presentations are pretty short, but there's a very large paper behind it, and this paper has been generated with the inputs of all the different 10 to 12 panel members, and they've all been asked to provide inputs, and all of the discussions afterwards, your questions, reflections, comments, will then be integrated into the final paper coming out of this session. What is the context of the market today? Well, of course, it's globalized, and in fact, almost 40% of all fish that is produced today, whether it's farmed or coming from wild fisheries, enters the enter international markets. And this is much, much more than for any other commodity in food commodity, whether it's from agriculture or anywhere else. And also, 50% of all fish that enters international markets comes from developing countries. This is also far more than for most other food products. On the import side, we have a lot of concentration. In fact, there are three big markets, US, Japan, and the EU, which represent more than 70% of all world imports. And that, of course, means that for an exporter, for a producer, if you are not able to adhere to the mandatory requirements of import to the EU, to the US, or to Japan, you are, in fact, shut out for more than 70% of your potential market. But in addition to the regulatory required import requirements, you also have the voluntary requirements, which are coming more and more onto the scene. Business-to-business requirements, whether they are related to product specifics, specifications, or certification. And the next presentation by Karuna Sugar, will deal more in detail with that. What then are the market access requirements? Well, I mentioned that not only are three big markets important, but in fact, if you look at the developed countries overall, almost 80% of all imports are represented by developed country imports, and 70%, again, of three markets alone. Of course, with all these requirements, you are adding costs, you are adding challenges to the producers, to the exporters, but without offering necessarily higher prices to offset those additional costs. And of course, this is a challenge. And over time, we have seen that the rise in consumption and imports in emerging economies, developing countries, in fact, are now increasing much, much faster than demand for fish and fishery products in the developed world. And this, of course, creates also opportunities for exporters and producers in developing countries themselves. Voluntary certification schemes exist both for wild and for farmed products. They're gaining market share in many developing country markets, but also in developing countries, especially in Asia, also South America. You have many examples now that consumers are more and more concerned about environmental issues, how the fish has been produced, and in fact are expressing a willingness also to look for labels that testify, that certify that that is the case. What then is one of the major impacts of this rise in aquaculture in international trade? We've spoken, especially yesterday and the day before, about how production in aquaculture has increased year by year. But of course, this has also a very large impact on markets, because when you find that almost or between 45 and 50% of all fish that is consumed by humans come from aquaculture, this changes completely the paradigm in international markets with a very large impact on prices, on product development, what kind of products, what kind of sizes, what kind of color, what kind of product forms that the retail sector in particular is able to source. Distribution issues are more and more driven by aquaculture than in the past. And also consumption patterns are evolving in trends with supply developments in aquaculture. At the same time, we have very large consumption differences for fish and fishery products all over the world. There are very large regional differences in fish consumption. If we have an average fish consumption per capita in the world of between 16 and 17 kilos, we still have areas such as Africa, South America, and Central America where you have consumption patterns that are exactly half of what is the world average. And, of course, this shows that we talk about, you know, consumption and we talk about globalization, but still we have to remember that there are very large differences in consumption, not only between region and regions, but also within the regions. For example, in Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe, probably the consumption figures are about half or even less than half of what you have for the European average. So we have to remember that we still have individual markets, and each market is different from the others. The urbanization and growth of modern distribution channels is also a phenomena which is not only focusing on developed countries. In fact, where urbanization is growing faster today is in developing countries, with very large implications for distribution, for fish distribution in particular, for our relevance, including the role of the retail sector in urban centers in developing countries as well. But it's also true that economic and cultural factors, including religious factors, continue to influence very strongly the level of fish consumption. And when we talk about globalization of fisheries, it's not only globalization of markets. In fact, it's the whole value chain from the production level all the way to the consumer. We've seen a long-term rise in aggregate trade values and volumes for all commodities. We've seen outsourcing both of production and of processing. In fact, when we say that 80 to 90% of all aquaculture production which takes place is taking place in developing countries, in many ways that is a conscious policy by developed countries which find very often more convenient to source products from aquaculture being produced elsewhere than in developed countries. This is very often the case, because of environmental issues, lack of space, lack of water, etc. There was a reference yesterday to some of the recent work we are doing in FAO on prices, and I think I'd like to mention this because it's very relevant for what we are talking about in aquaculture. In fact, in FAO, we've constructed an index which shows the price developments of fish and fishery products over the last 10 years. And what is interesting to see is that there is a complete diverse development in prices for wild products and for aquaculture products. And whereas the price on wild products has increased, we've seen that today the price on aquaculture products in nominal values, and even worse in absolute values, of course, is below what it was 10 years ago. So on the average, aquaculture products today have a lower price in the market than it had 10 years ago. And of course, this is related to cost reductions, economies of scale, etc. But it also something we have to remember that despite this very large growth in demand, in fact, the price and the cost issue is fundamental. As Lara Barassi also mentioned yesterday, there are a lot of competitive sources of protein out there. International trade, you know very well that it increased very quickly until 2008. We had a very large fall in 2009, but all the statistics and trade figures for 2010 show that we have new growth in 2010. We will not reach the level we had in 2008 this year, but probably in 2011 we'll see the same level of international trade in fish and fishery products as we saw in 2008. What is then the future impact of aquaculture? Well, I think we will see a lot of changes and we will see a lot of growth in the impact of aquaculture. If we go down the road like 10 years from now, we'll see that of all fish that is consumed by humans, between 60 and 70% would come from aquaculture. And that means that aquaculture products, prices, seasonality or lack of seasonality will drive supply and drive price formation in the fisheries sector much, much more than it has done so far. So we'll see a much larger role for aquaculture in its impact on demand, on supply, on consumer issues, on trends, on needs, etc., that we've seen until today. We'll also see a very large impact on product development, what kind of products we'll see. And of course, it challenges the sector's ability to respond to these evolving consumers' needs and to the challenges reflected by this growth. Of course, there are environmental and social constraints, but I think the potential for growth and economic success for the sector are evident, but so are also the challenges presented to the world's aquaculture producers. And with that, I remind you again that there's much, much more on this in the paper for this session, but now I leave the more interesting stuff to Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. For the second part of this presentation, I'll introduce to you to Mr. Jonathan Banks from the UK, who is, during more than 30 years, has been in the fast-moving consumer goods industry. Mr. Banks has held senior sales and marketing positions in multinational manufacturers and a retailer. He recently left Nielsen, the world's largest market research group. For the last 7 years, he has their European Business Insight Director. Jonathan specializes in tracking and predicting consumer behavior and trends to help manufacturers and retailers formulate winning strategies. He's a widely recognized figure in British and international media, as well as being a prominent speaker and a moderator at key industry events around the world. So, Jonathan, I'll leave you here for the second part. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, hi, everybody. I'm very pleased and would like to thank the FAO and the organizers for inviting me to be here, because one of the things that I've noticed in my work is that the companies that I've been speaking to around the world, be they manufacturers or retailers, the ones that have been the most successful have been the ones that have been concentrating the most on the consumer. So lots of companies put a lot of effort into finding out what their consumers want, but what differentiates the really successful ones is the ones that then put a lot of effort into giving it to them. And so that's why I'm pleased to have this session here to talk a little bit about the consumer. And I should also thank Nielsen, my previous employers, for letting me continue to use their data, even though I'm no longer in the business there. So to start off with, things are looking pretty good in terms of your ability to add value and sell more products to more people. We have a global population currently at about 6.8 billion. That's going to carry on rising until the year 2050 and then level off at about 9.2 billion. So as suppliers, then if you want to grow your business, all you've got to do is hold share, and your business will grow with the growth of population. It's actually better than that, though, because have a look at this chart here. This is showing the growth in those that are classified as middle class. And what you can see is that it took about 40 years for the number of middle class people in the world to double. And then in the last 15 years, it doubled again. The pace of change got quicker and quicker. But just have a look at where this line goes, admittedly on forecasts, and forecasts have been wrong. But hopefully that will give you some confidence about your ability to add value. Because one of the things that I note is that this is not just a fish industry issue. As Auden was saying, you know, prices are lower now than they were 10 years ago. This is happening in category after category. The increasing commoditization is something which, as consumers, is great for us, because that means you're getting more value for money. But, of course, as a supplier, with shareholders to please, then life's getting tougher. And against that growth in middle class, of course, we've had the financial crash of 2 years ago, the credit crunch, which I know has affected some countries worse than others. Where I come from, we were hideously irresponsible in the way we were organizing our finances. So it's affected us more than others. Just to show you some numbers, this is, just before I show you the numbers, just to explain the chart, this is looking at consumers' financial confidence. So the numbers I'm going to show you are a construct based on the answers to questions like, what do you think about your job prospects over the next 12 months? Do you think now's a good time to be spending money? And a score above 100 means people are positive and confident about the future, and below 100 means people are negative. So just over the last few years, this is for the big five European countries. So that's Let me say, UK. Last time I listed the big five European countries, I forgot my own. So I'll start with the UK, but it's UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain. And what you can see is that the average for those big five countries, we never got between us above 100. In fact, in the UK, we popped above 100 back in 2006, and that feels like a lifetime ago. And you can see we hit an all-time low last April, since when we've had a slight bounce, but we're still strongly negative. To show you what good looks like, go to Norway, where Auden is from. And, of course, in Norway, they had the great benefit of staying out of the European Union, which was a marvellous move. And they've also got the benefit of having a lot of oil. So when oil, a couple of years ago, when that went up to $147 a barrel, that was great news for the Norwegians, but, of course, bad news for the rest of us. But Norway, the only European country scoring above 100. There's Japan at the other end of the scale. Now, one of the things that you have to be careful of with market research is that, you know, what people say and what they mean can be two different things. So what we have to also bear in mind when we're looking at this kind of data, and I could show you a similar track for Korea as well, is that it's a cultural thing that, you know, people tend to say things are worse than they really are in this kind of market research. On the other hand, if we went to the Philippines, then it's the opposite, and people tend to say things are better than what they are. So maybe what we should just be looking at is the shape of the line, which you can see is similar to the Norwegian and the European lines. I was in Brazil last week, and there they've had their economic miracle, which seems to continue unabated. So they've got some fun coming up with the election, and the political ramifications of that will be interesting to see. But they are consistently scoring above 100. The USA, who started the credit crunch for us, that's what it looks like there. And when we ask people, what are you worried about? Then what's happened is that all the kind of social concerns, you can see I've picked out in red here, things like concerns about our children, our parents, work-life balance, they've all been shoved down this league table. 2 years ago, health would have been right at the top in most countries. But now, of course, you can see in black all of these financial worries. Down at the bottom in blue, you can see 2% say they've got no concerns when asked, what is your biggest and second biggest concern? So clearly these people do not understand the mess that we're in. Or maybe they're drinking something. I need to get some of them. I don't know what it is, but that's what the people say. So it's the financial worries that are now really taking over from social worries. And then, having asked this question, compared to this time last year, which of the following actions have you taken to save on household expenditure? Now you see right down the bottom, very few people say I'll give up smoking. Very few people say I'll give up alcohol. You know, we're so worried about what's going on that we need to drink and smoke just to cope. But again, be careful with this kind of market research, because at the top here you'll see switching to cheaper grocery brands. Now, the reason that I want to emphasize this is because, as I said, what people say and what they mean are sometimes two different things. What people say and what they do can be two different things, and this is a very good example of that. Because actually, if I say to you as a consumer, look, things are really tough, aren't they? So are you going to try and save money by switching to cheaper grocery brands? It's almost forcing you to say yes. But when you look at the data, that is not what's in the data. People are not switching to cheaper grocery brands as that might suggest. The problem is that a lot of marketeers don't realize that. So we get into a series of self-fulfilling prophecies. So if as a head office retail buyer you say, well, my shoppers are going to want to buy more products which are on promotion, I will give them more promotions, people buy more on promotion. If, by the same token, you say, well, you know, I think people are going to want to buy fewer premium products and more cheaper products, so I'll de-emphasize the premium lines I've got and put more cheaper products out. Well, you know, I'm always asking myself, do people want what they get, or do they get what they want? And the more data I look at, the more I realize that people want what they get. In other words, the choices that you give them is what dictates their purchasing behavior. So when you see numbers like this, scary though they are, please ignore them, because you can actually overcome that by just marketing more accurately to people. And one of the reasons you can do that is explained by this rather complicated chart. So let me just spend a second to explain it to you. Along the x-axis, the horizontal axis, you've got the percentage of our household expenditure that goes on food. And going up the y-axis, the vertical axis, is our wealth, as expressed by per capita GDP. So, for example, if I was a peasant in India earning less than $1.25 a day, then 100% of my income would be going on food. The number for India, by the way, is 57%. You know, these are just averages. And we need to be careful of averages because, of course, averagely, you know, if I had my head in an oven and my feet in a freezer, averagely I'm okay. But that's not quite really what that's saying. So be careful. Of course, and my point is that in most rich Western countries, we are spending only about 10% of our household expenditure on food. So despite the fact that we had all that massive do you remember the inflation we had a couple of years ago? Despite the fact that we had all that massive inflation, despite the fact we've got more inflation coming through the system now, actually food expenditure remains pretty level. People are not trying to cut as much as some of the market research might suggest they are. And so I'm showing you this because I want you to have the confidence to continue to develop your categories, to invest in research and development and new product development, and do not be afraid to add value and charge more. Now, one of the other things that we need to bear in mind is we are shopping differently. So this is looking at retailing in Europe, and it's an average of where we are spending our money in terms of our grocery shopping in Europe. And this bottom section in dark green is the percentage of shopping that we are doing in hypermarkets. So that's stores larger than 2,500 square meters, or about 25,000 square feet in old money. And what you can see is that over the last 30 years, we have almost tripled the amount of spending that we do in these very, very large stores. We've doubled the amount of spending that we do in large supermarkets. And the section of the retail trade that's not been able to cope with this are the small convenience stores, the mom-and-pop stores, and the specialists. They have been unable to compete with the onslaught from these large organized stores. And, of course, the other thing that's been happening is we've had retailing gradually become more internationalized. So compared with other industries, grocery retailing is not very internationalized at all. If you add up the top 50 supermarket share of world retailing, it comes to about maybe 20%, depending on how you do the arithmetic. But if you took the top 50 companies, say, in the automotive industry or telephony, then they're about 99% of those industries. So grocery retailing has still got a long way to go. But because of this growing share that fewer owners of the retail business have got, that's what's driven this growth that we see in private label. So this growth that we see in private label, around about half a percentage point or three quarters of a percentage point each year, that's got nothing to do with the recession. That's got nothing to do with people trying to save money. This is due to more of the retail estate being owned by fewer retailers. And so therefore, if you are a head office buyer in whatever category, then you are more likely to have the critical mass available to you to make more private label SKUs a financially viable proposition. And when you do private label as a head office buyer, that's great news for you because that increases your percentage profit on return. And that's your number one objective as a head office buyer. So that's why that's happening. But you can be the masters of your own destiny. And I can show you lots of data to demonstrate it, but I would rather actually just show you a couple of pictures because people will spend more money on brands. And to prove it, I don't know what you think that polo shirt is worth. But if you look at it now, I'm sure you'll agree it's worth more. Or if I was in a different target audience, now it might be worth more. But only brands can do that. Carrefour can't do that. Metro can't do that. Walmart can't do that. Tesco can't do that. Only brands can do that. And so what are the things that you can do as potential brand owners, as potential developers of products to add value? What I'd noticed before the recession, but then during the recession and after the recession, is that there are four big mega trends which are adding value. So I'm not talking here about fads and fashions which come and go. These are things which are sustained and sustaining. The first is that people will pay more for things which are convenient and practical. There's a whole generation of people where I come from that have grown up not actually being able to cook. So when you can give them ready meal or options or things which enable them to put the product together onto the plate more quickly, more easily, and with less fuss, then that will be of benefit to people and they'll pay more for it. People are also still prepared to pay more for things which are good for their health and their well-being. People need a lot of help in that. Don't forget we have still the growing problems from obesity, which continues to grow in country after country. But it's no good taking the sugar, fat and salt out of your products and saying, right, it's healthy, because people also want them to taste great as well. So that's another very important thing. And then finally, as Auden was saying, then we need to make sure also that what we are doing is being produced on an ethical basis. And this covers a multitude of sins. It means different things to different people, huge amount of consumer confusion as to what's the right thing to do. But, you know, here we are talking about it could be organic, it could be fair trade, low carbon emissions, not using child labour in the factories, all sorts of things involved there. But increasingly, consumers want to know that the companies that they are buying from are doing the right thing. So, you know, when I buy a pair of Nike running shoes, I want to know child labour wasn't used in the factory. We increasingly want to know that rainforests aren't being destroyed, that the environment is being protected by the companies that we are buying food from. Or when we ask people, can you agree with this statement? I'm concerned about the overuse of global fish stocks. Yes, people do agree with it, but actually, when you dive into it, people don't really understand the issues. What they need you to do is to do what we call choice editing on their behalf. It's up to you to do the right thing. Increasingly, retailers will put you under pressure to do the right thing because they want to for their own reasons as well. And yeah, you could look at which are the countries where you've got the strongest agreement with these and then think, okay, so that's where I need an MSC label or something like that. But actually what I think you should be concentrating more on are the reasons that people don't want to eat fish. Because if you want to add value and you can solve some of these problems, then I think, again, you can add more value. So just to show you that the percentage of people that were agreeing with these statements I've put on the left-hand side here, there are some who are saying it's not easily available. So, for example, if you're in India where you haven't got a good chill chain, then it's actually physically difficult. And also, of course, if you haven't got a fridge or a freezer at home, then that also makes fish an awkward category to buy into. But that growth in middle class that I was showing you, that means that in the future, more people are going to have refrigerators and freezers in their homes, which opens up more opportunities for you. There are some who say, I don't know how to cook it. So there you can do some ready meal solutions, perhaps. There are some that don't like the appearance. So, okay, take the head off. Just make it easy for them. Get rid of the fins and scales. Some people say, yeah, I'm opposed to eating fish because of my personal beliefs. 17% saying it's too expensive. Here's an important one. 21% saying, I don't like the bones. Just guarantee that you're going to be taking as many of the bones out as you can. 32% say, I don't like the smell. And this one I'm not quite sure about. 33% saying, I don't like the taste. Personally, I think, what's not to like? But I guess that depends whether you're buying or selling. So maybe that's just a question of coming up with some more imaginative sources to put on the product. So that's one area to look at. Another thing to look at is to ask yourself, is the glass half full or half empty? Two ways to grow your volume. One is to increase penetration, i.e. get more households buying in. The other is to get the households that are buying it to buy more frequently. This chart is looking at frequency. So in countries around here, like the Philippines and Malaysia, people are consuming fish 2-3 times a week at least. But on the other hand, if you go to countries in the bottom right-hand corner, there people are consuming fish maybe once a week, twice a week at most. The average globally is 1.6 times a week. That tells me that with 7 days in the week, if we're only at 1.6, that shows me there's an awful lot of headroom for the category. So, some closing thoughts for you. We have great opportunities for the industry, for the future, partly because of just the growth in population tells you that your market's growing, but also concentrate on that growth in the middle class. Yes, consumer confidence is low, and we've seen that economic worries are dominating, but that's a transient thing, and it doesn't impact as much as you might expect on food purchasing. Yes, if we were in the automotive industry, you know, then that would be different. Yes, there would be blood on the walls then, because people have learned that you don't need to buy a new car every year. If we were in the holiday industry, yeah, that would be different as well. People have learned they don't need to have 3 holidays a year. They certainly don't need to have long-haul holidays all the time. You can have holidays in your own country. And these are some new behaviors that people are learning. But so when it comes to food, at only 10% of our household expenditure, food is actually a cheap treat, and people will continue to spend on it. So yes, there are lots of downward pressures on pricing from the growth of the multinational retailers, from the growth of private label, from the growth of promotional activity. But on the other hand, you can push back against that with products which appeal to those four big mega trends that I showed you earlier. So people want things which are convenient, which are good for their health, which taste great, and are also produced on an ethical basis. So when it comes to the opportunities for you, there are lots there, but of course I recognize I've got the easy job because all I have to do is look at what's going on and talk about it. You guys have got the hard job because you've got to do something with that. So let me just close by wishing you all the very best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Ottoman and Jonathan, for a very inspiring and very great presentation. I would like to invite now the people that were in the panel of experts that participated in to produce this invitation. So if someone of them are in the room, please come and have a seat here. So we'll have open the floor for questions that anybody of you can have. So anybody of the panel experts, please take a seat. If I guess there might be a lot of questions or ideas that we want to share in between everybody, and obviously for that we have open microphones here for to do the different questions to the audience, to the presenters, and to the panel experts that participated here. So, opening the floor. Any question? Please, yourself. No, him first. After you. Yes. Any of the microphones will do.
I'm Michael James from Adelaide, South Australia. Jonathan put up the barriers to fish consumption, so one could address those in isolation. There's a smart move in marketing to compare seafood with the opposition. So seafood's up against chicken and red meat. And in the major markets, which are the US and certainly Australia, which I know, which is not a major market, red meat's relatively cheap and plentiful, and same in the US. So in marketing, is it a smart move or a foolish move to try and position seafood against the opposition, or do you just try and address the barriers in isolation?
Yeah, personally, I think you've got nothing to be worried about in terms of comparisons. You mentioned red meat, but there's a move for meat-free, was it meat-free Mondays or Fridays? I can't remember.
Fridays, was it?
Yeah, because of the high carbon emissions on meat. So one of the things that the chicken industry is saying is, look, you know, we've got much lower carbon emissions than beef, so eat more chicken. So one of the things that people might worry about with fish is that it's being air freighted from thousands of miles away, but if you do the carbon audits, then you find actually you've probably got a story which stacks up from that point of view. But you've also got a story which stacks up from all sorts of other points of view, just in terms of the versatility of the product, the fact that it's just nice to, if you are feeding your family, to give them something different and not necessarily unusual, because a lot of us don't like unusual. But I was in South America last week. If you're in Argentina, it's beef morning, noon and night. You know, it gets a bit monotonous. So I think we've got a lot to go for there, and I wouldn't be afraid of making comparisons at all. In terms of, you know, dollars per kilo, in terms of the price that you pay, you've probably got beef at the top. Well, fish can be probably the most expensive per kilo. But again, you know, think about portion control, and that way then you can actually say, well, you know, what's the cost of this nice healthy meal? And then finally, as I should get Roy to say this, don't forget, you know, most governments are saying we should be eating two portions of oily fish each week. So there's a very strong health argument as well.
Yeah, just to add to that, Michael, and you know, in Australia, and then we have a big competition because we have, you know, the meat and livestock have like levies, and most of the primary industry groups in Australia, except seafood, have levies. So the meat and livestock have about $90 million a year to spend on promotions, and we have nothing. So that helps their sales, I think, tremendously, and it's something that I'm keen to try and change in Australia and trying to go around the world trying to promote that activity, that we need to really get people into eating more seafood from the health aspect and getting people to understand that more. But, yeah, we've got... So we can't really compete because in some respects because we don't have the funding to do that. But there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that we can grab hold of and utilize, and that's what we really need to do, I think, around the world.
I would add to that that it might be a good market for some aquaculture companies to be in, mostly large-scale operations with a massive production that can generate profit in a low-margin environment, but it's not certainly not a smart market to be in for some other companies with smaller scale operations and higher cost of productions that would prefer to operate in high margin markets where there is a necessity to add value to the product.
Thank you. You want to rebut something? I have several questions on the floor, so okay. That's okay, then? You want to rebut something? But I don't want to encourage the... Okay, thank you.
I think fish can compete in terms of health against red meat and chicken. But what I've heard over the last 2 days is there's a big push, and understandably so, to get rid of the fish oil, the fish meal from fish feeds. You're going to lose this health benefit as you get the omega-3s out. And I can understand why it's happening, sustainability cost. But what you might gain in cost and efficiency of production, you might lose in this health benefit, which fish has as a comparator.
Okay. Thank you. The lady there, yes. Please.
Sally Surang-Pimon, director of the Food School. I've had this nagging thought since the beginning of the conference, but also even earlier in my work for many, many years with developing countries, enabling producers to gain access to markets in developed countries. And over the years, I've realized that a lot of the talk about market access revolves around commercial, industrial or commercial, in this case, for this conference, the commercial aquaculture part. But very little really is being paid attention in terms of food aquaculture, which is gaining more and more importance. And I talk about this because I've gotten involved with artisanal fisheries and also small-scale farms, which are very dependent on those for their livelihood. They're not even thinking of opportunities for exports. They're thinking of feeding their community. Mm-hmm. And so my question to the panel is really, because this is a conference on food, not only food, the people come first, actually, in the title, which I like about the title. And a lot of the talk about market access look at developing countries as sources, suppliers for this. What about their people? Where do we get the balance for the food aquaculture part and also the commercial aquaculture part? And really, we have to ask the question of whether the efforts that go into encouraging exports, are they really worth it? In Canada, what we're finding out, there's a very strong movement for the 100-mile diet and also looking at the water footprint and the carbon footprint of the food you eat.
Okay.
And so this is a question I would like to pose to the panel and also the people here.
Okay. So anybody want to?
Well, maybe I can just say briefly that fish is a very internationally traded product, and the export activity, especially from developing country, has very large positive economic implications for those producing countries. In fact, on an annual basis, the net export revenues to developing countries only are more than $25 billion, and that net export revenue, $25 billion, is more than the combined net export revenues to developing countries of all the other food agricultural products. Tea, coffee, meat, sugar, bananas, etc. So it shows the importance of fish production, of fish exports. But of course, your point in ensuring domestic food security is very valid. But we have seen and we have shown through many examples and many studies that the positive economic impact from fish export far outweighs those negative implications that may be present. And in fact, when I mentioned that fish in value is exported, that of course is true, But it's also true that developing countries import a lot of fish from other developing countries, but also from developed countries, but very often much lower value fish. High quality in terms of nutrition, in terms of protein, but a low value in terms of price.
Thank you, Adam. I have another question there, Courtney.
Thank you, Chairman. Courtney Hupp from the Federation of European Agriculture Producers. In the late 90s, there was a boom in quality schemes, if one remembers this, post mad cow disease, post dioxin crisis. And these are rapidly being replaced by labels to do with, for example, fair trade or environmental issues. And this is making it extremely confusing for the individual companies to know how to adapt to that. One of the things, or one of the thoughts that is coming up, is also in some market research that we saw recently, is the replacement of trust in a brand going towards the faith or confidence in the supermarket itself. In other words, replacement of the confidence in your quality label or your brand by actually just where you're going to the supermarket, and this could be related to the amount of time you're prepared to put over purchasing. Now, do you have any thoughts on that? Because when you look at the trade issues, how on earth are producers who are going to export or be active in that be able to adapt to that, because it will have very little to do with how they produce. It'll just be where they sell. And I don't know whether you have any thoughts on this. Ask the panel for their ideas.
Okay, great question. Thank you. So first point is consumers get incredibly confused by the multiplicity of labels that go on the packaging that they buy. It's worse than that, though. I mean, for instance, if we take organic, then it's being put forward. When people are asked, why are you buying organic, then they will say, because it's more nutritious, because it's healthier, because it's better for the planet. And, of course, when you get into the detail, for some products, none of those statements are true. And so, therefore, this element of trust can very quickly get eroded if everybody in the industry, and I'm not just talking about the fish industry, but if everybody is not doing things with total integrity. We therefore make a bit of a rod for our own back. And yes, it's true, we will trust Tesco. In the UK where I come from, we trust Tesco more than we probably trust the police, which might not be much of a claim, but that's the reality. The other thing that's also in terms of trust, another thing we have to watch out for, is that you can measure the reduction in the trust in advertising. So where I come from, if you want to put an advertisement on the television, it needs to be legal, decent, honest, and truthful. On the other hand, you can print any lies you like on the internet in a totally unregulated way. But the problem is this: people believe what they read in the blogosphere more than what they'll see on the television. So then when you start reading about some of the made-up health scares on the internet, then this is another big issue for us in the industry, because people don't understand the science, and then we make it worse if we don't act with total integrity.
I had a question up there. Then yourself and you.
Thank you, Khalid Saleh from South Africa. In order to do a campaign on the promotion of eating fish and all the health benefits, I would like to hear the thoughts of the panel on how much should come ideally from the government in terms of the campaign and from the private sector. Is there some ideas?
Yeah, I've got a good idea, 100% from the government. but I don't think that actually happens. I think at the end of the day, industry has to take some responsibility for this. But I also believe that, there's an issue of prevention better than cure that isn't necessarily getting through to a lot of our governments. They talk about it, but they still continue to build hospitals and try and get more medical staff on, et cetera, et cetera, where effectively a lot of the issues that we have could be dealt with by a better understanding of nutrition and working on that basis. So if I might get a plug in, International Seafood and Health Conference in Melbourne in November, and you should all be there to hear and see what's going on, because we have all these experts coming and interacting with the public, covering all those areas that Jonathan's made point of.
I had another question there, please.
Yes, Jean Dont from Ghent University, Belgium. I was intrigued by a statement by Ms. Baradzi yesterday from Cefalonia Fisheries, who explained to what great lengths she went to produce a premium product, but what was the use if the consumer cannot tell the difference between a premium product and a pangasius, even if it's on health and nutritionally wise comparable maybe, but how can you educate an effective way your consumer to spend more money on a better product?
Okay, and the short answer from me is that you don't develop a premium brand overnight. This is something which takes a long, long time and a lot of investment, but in the long run, it's worth it. If you look at some of the great brands that we have got, not in the fish industry, but say take Stella Artois beer. If you look at a label of Stella, that looks pretty much the same now as it looked 50 years ago, or actually Budweiser, the label on a can of Budweiser, I'm sorry to talk about beer a lot, but it's close to my heart. A can of Budweiser now looks pretty much the same as it looked 100 years ago in terms of the label. The advertising for Cadbury's chocolate with a glass and a half of full cream dairy milk, that campaign has been running since the 1920s. So that's how you develop premium brands. So don't think it's going to be done quickly, easily, or overnight, but if you work at it, the rewards are there for you.
It's a lot also about understanding what a consumer would like to buy. So if you can understand that point, then you can develop products that will fit that demand.
Thank you. I have another question here, and I'll have time for probably one or two more questions, and then we'll have to close. So it's going to be you and yourself.
Thank you. The present Mohan from NACA. The present trends, what we see in accessing the markets and the need for responsible and sustainable aquaculture through labeling, certification, and all this is very, very good. I think at the same time, we should think like small-scale farmers are also dependent on many of these export-traded commodities. We are all aware of shrimp and other things. What I feel is, to a large extent, one side of the story is being focused. The cost of compliance, very few studies have been done on the cost of compliance. Unless, I think, we seriously investigate the cost of compliance and come up with good strategies so that, you know, these large sectors are not left out of this competitive trade, you know. We have done few studies on cost of compliance, and we find it's not easy for small-scale sector to comply with all the standards that are prescribed with the labels of the supermarket chains. So I think there is a need for a big investment, either government or international, to go to really make a thorough assessment of the cost of compliance and what modifications can be done for the standards or indicators, and then how can we, you know, take the sector along with us, not just leave the sector completely or only advocate vertical integration, you know. So I would like to hear the views of the panel. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's important maybe to realize that it's very difficult to change the rules of the game, but what you can do, you can try to enable the small-scale producers to adhere to the requirements, to help them organize, to help them through clusters or other ways of cooperation to enable them to adhere to the requirements. But trying to change the rules, I think, is more difficult.
But I would like to join Sally on your comment about the fact, wondering if it's worse for small-scale farmer to target export markets, which now operate in a very low-margin environment and where they will have many difficulties competing with large-scale operations that can operate in that environment because they produce massive volumes and very efficiently. So I think for small-scale farmers, we need to think about a combination of different markets and different products for local markets and feeding their people in their community and maybe targeting some export markets, but I think targeting value-added markets. And I really think there might be something special about the way small farmers operate, the quality of the food they produce, and they can take benefits of that through labels and differentiation, but they need to collaborate with the supply chain and the market operators to identify these points of difference and market them.
Yeah, I just got a point on that. I think that we've also gone down this route, particularly with the supermarkets, and they're always looking for their point of difference. And so they keep adding to the food safety or sustainability or all these other situations. And I think, you know, before we should allow them to actually put these things in, we should actually say, well, give us the cost-benefit analysis of this before we even start allowing you to actually have that sort of standard in a sense. Because, you know, you don't get any more for your product to meet that particular standard. And then the other thing you've got is all these audits, you know. If you have, there are factories that have all these different audits going on, and it's all just an enormous expense. And there needs to be some collaboration in that area. And ideally, what I think we need is, and we actually did a lot of work on this in Australia, but it sort of died a little bit, was on a seafood standard. So that we have one standard, and we say to the supermarkets, look, we've reached all these particular areas, you know, take this seafood standard, and by all means add your brand to it, but enable us to be able to work in that area.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I have another question here. Another one that was kind of in the back. Yes, and then finally you. Yes, please.
Steve Deck, Philippines. This is not a question to the panel, but I'd like to share the concern of the lady here. It's about how do we help the small-scale operators in terms of mainstreaming them in the global market. There are a lot of initiatives going on now, but really we really have to help them. No? We have to organize them. We have to teach them not only to be farmers but to be entrepreneurs. No? In fact, in the region, Southeast Asian region, there are a lot of initiatives like one town, one product. There's some kind of market needs, no? And slowly they become evident in the market. So slowly, they may not be able to tap the big global market, but the space that was given to them because of globalization of the market, they can now tap the immediate market. And hopefully, maybe we could mainstream them more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yourself there, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm from FAO. So my question is more or less related with Muhan and also the previous gentleman. So the theme here is to facilitate the market access for producers. But we have to remember the world aquaculture production, let's say 60-70% are from the small producers. So the market is changing, the demand of the consumers is changing. It's definitely got impacts on the small producers. Hmm. I hope the panel will put forward some recommendations. How can we facilitate the marketing access of the small aquaculture producers? Thanks.
Thank you. You had a question there.
Hi, my name is Simon Bush from Wageningen University. It's actually a follow-up, Roy, with your point about supermarkets and competition, and in particular to the rise of home brands and the rise of retail when it comes to claiming value on sustainability, and in particular the claim within Europe of a lot of and US of only selling sustainable seafood by 2015. So I'm wondering if all of these supermarkets are only selling sustainable seafood, how are they then, or can you comment on how they're then going to claim value, make any marginal value out of a claim on sustainability for those fish?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just before I give the microphone to Roy, I just snatched it back off him. The point is that those kinds of claims are not in the future going to be claims by which supermarkets can differentiate. They will just be claims which are table stakes just to get them into the game, in the same way as having a car park is not a differentiator for a supermarket. That's just table stakes. So being right on those things, again, for all those supermarkets will be a differentiator, will cease to be a differentiator, will just be table stakes, and if you're not doing it, then they will be removed from increasing number of consumers' repertoire.
And the other fear, of course, is they go on to something else after they've reached the pinnacle of sustainability. They'll move on to animal welfare. They move on to all these other areas, and that's something we've got to be aware of. And I think we need to be seeing something like the NGOs have done in ranking. You know, we should be doing something on supermarkets, ranking about the wastages that they have within their businesses and really start honing in. Well, if you're really keen about sustainable fisheries, then let's have a look at what your wastage is. Let's declare that. Let's see how much you're over-ordering and wasting, you know. These are things that maybe we should be doing back because there's an enormous amount of wastage that goes on and we need to start doing something about that. So I think there's some responsibility on us, but we're not really all together. You know, we're not as well organized internationally as we should be. And hopefully we can, you know, when we come across these issues, we might start getting a little bit stronger from that point of view. Anyone who wants to talk about that, I'm happy to help try and get that happening.
Thank you very much. I think that our panel are experts. They deserve a big applause from all of you. And thank you very much for this very interesting and vigorous conversation that we have had.